Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are really glad you sent this one in. It's a fantastic topic.
Yeah, the whole economics of the NBA thing. It feels like something everyone thinks they get, right? The salary cap, max deals. But when you actually peel back the layers, like with the sources you sent, especially that blog post digging into the research, it gets, well, complicated. Fast.
It really does.
Yeah.
And it raises a crucial question. What does that cap actually do for the players? Not just the teams, but the guys earning the salaries.
Exactly. Does it really help the middle class player like it was supposed to? Or does all that money just flow upwards?
Well, that's the core of it. The NBA isn't a free-for-all market, obviously. It's got these complex rules, collective bargaining, but it structures where the money goes.
So that's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to unpack the research you shared, look at the data, and try to figure out what's really going on with player pay, especially for that middle tier since the modern cap came in.
Let's do it. First, a little history, maybe. The NBA salary cap story is kind of weird.
Where'd happen? Well, technically, the first cap was way back in 1946 when it was the BAA. But that didn't last long. The one everyone talks about, the modern era, that kicked off in 1984.
Okay, 84. But getting there wasn't simple, right? The sources mentioned a lot about player power growing.
Oh, absolutely. You had the Players Union getting recognized back in the mid-60s. They started fighting for the basics, minimum salaries, pensions, benefits, that kind of stuff. And they really pushed on collective bargaining, especially with the rival ABA league popping up that created, competition for players.
The ABA effect. And wasn't there that whole thing with the merger? The players weren't exactly thrilled at first.
Right. That's a key point in the sources. The Oscar Robertson case in the early 70s. The players sued to block the merger, partly because they were worried losing the ABA competition would, well, suppress salaries.
So they were already thinking strategically about money way back then. That lawsuit showed some serious muscle delaying the merger.
Exactly. It signaled they were a force to be reckoned with, focused on their financial futures. Even though the merger happened eventually and wages didn't totally tank long term like some feared, it definitely set the stage for more structured bargaining later on.
Which leads us back to 1984 and the modern cap. What were the official reasons for bringing it in? The sources mentioned a couple of main goals.
Yeah, the stated purposes were pretty clear. One was competitive balance, trying to stop teams in huge markets with deep pockets from just buying up all the talent, level the playing field for teams.
Okay, competitive balance makes sense. And the other goal.
The other one, and this is central to what we're digging into, was explicitly to help ensure the middle class of players got fair compensation. It was part of the pitch.
So protect the journeymen, the solid role players, not just the superstars or the guys on minimum deals. Interesting.
And of course, that cap number hasn't stayed still since '84. It's grown massively. The league's revenues exploded, especially from TV deals, and the cap followed suit. The research shows those figures climbing pretty steadily over the years, even adjusting for inflation.
Yeah, I saw that in the tables. Some years just small bumps, others bigger. But then you get to those years mentioned in the blog post, 2016-17 and 2017-18. Whoa.
Right, that massive new TV contract kicked in. The cap jumped to, what was it, $90 million, then $108 million. Huge increases.
The blog post called them out specifically like 29%, then 20% jumps year over year. That's wild. The data showed that apart from one other big spike back in 95-96 after a CBA change.
Yeah, that was a 44% jump. Also huge.
Apart from that, those 2 years around 2016-2017 represented like an unprecedented surge in just how much new money was suddenly available.
Totally. Think about it like your own budget suddenly swelling by nearly a third one year, then another fifth the next. That's the
And
context.
that massive influx of cash really frames the core question of the research you sent, doesn't it?
Precisely. With all that new money pouring in, on top of years of growth, did the salary cap structure actually do what it was partly intended to do? Did it protect that middle class?
Or did the rich just get richer, so to speak? Did the superstars soak up most of that new windfall?
That's what the study tried to pin down. And first, they needed to define middle class clearly.
How'd they do that?
Kept it straightforward based on the data. Each season, they ranked all the players by salary and just took the middle third. So if you had, say, 450 players, ranks 151 through 300 were the middle class for that year.
Simple enough. Top third, middle third, bottom third. And the data they used.
It was pretty extensive. Covered over 12,000 player seasons going back to 1984. They had to patch it together from various sources. The blog mentions old newspaper archives like the Dallas Morning News, plus sites like Real GM for more recent stuff, focused on full season deals, adjusted for lockout.
Okay, solid data set. And the blog mentioned an initial chart kind of showing the trend visually.
Yeah, figure two in the paper. If you just plot the cumulative share of total league earnings for each tier over time, it kind of looks like the middle tier's slice is shrinking.
Just eyeballing it, it seems like the middle guys are getting a smaller piece of the pie as time goes on.
Exactly. But, you know, visual trends can be tricky, especially when the pie itself is growing so much and dollar values change. So they needed a better way to compare across eras.
Right, because $1 million in 1990 is way different than $1 million in 2015.
Precisely. So the key methodological step was looking at each player's salary, not in absolute dollars, but as a percentage of the salary cap for that specific season.
Ah, okay. So how much of the available cap space did a player's salary represent that normalizes it?
Exactly. It lets you compare, say, a top-tier salary percentage in 1988 to a top-tier percentage in 2012, apples to apples, relative to the economic context of their time.
Smart. So they standardized the salary gated that way. Then how did they actually test if the shares were changing and how?
They use a couple of main statistical techniques. First, something called an ANOVA test.
ANOVA? Sounds serious.
It basically asks, for each tier, top, middle, bottom, did their average percentage of the cap significantly change from season to season over the whole period? Or was it pretty stable? It tests if there's any statistically significant variation happening over time within each group.
Okay, so does the average middle class salary percentage bounce around randomly, or is there a real trend of change?
Kind of. And then to see the direction and strength of that change, especially in relation to overall spending, they use regression analysis.
Regression? Okay, I've heard of that. Like drawing a trend line.
Pretty much. It quantifies the relationship. Specifically, it asks, for every extra dollar the league spends on total player salaries in a season, how many cents of that dollar, on average, go to the top tier? How many to the middle, and how many to the bottom.
Gotcha. So it tells you who benefits most when the overall salary spending goes up.
Exactly. And the source material mentions they didn't just look at the whole 1984-2015 period together. They also broke it down to look specifically at the period after the 1995 collective bargaining agreement.
Right, because that CBA brought in some big structural changes, didn't it? Like the rookie wage scale.
Yeah, that was huge. Fixed salaries for rookies based on draft position. Mm. Also, limits on how long contracts could be. And crucially, changes to how basketball-related income, the BRI, was defined and split.
BRI, that's the big pot of money the league and players share, right? TV deals, tickets, jerseys, all that stuff.
Yep. And getting a bigger defined slice of that pie was a major goal for the players' union in 95 and subsequent deals.
Okay, so let's get to the results. What did the stats say? First, that ANOVA test, did the average salary percentages change significantly over time for the tiers?
Yes, they did. Big time. The ANOVA showed statistically significant differences in the average cap percentage for all three tiers over the years. Things definitely weren't static.
Okay, so everyone's relative share was changing somehow, but how? Was the middle tier's share going up, down, staying flat relative to the others?
Well, here's something interesting the source highlights from the ANOVA results first. While all tiers showed significant change, the F statistics, which kind of measure the magnitude of the variation, were actually much larger for the middle and bottom tiers than for the top tier.
Wait, larger for the middle and bottom, what does that mean? More volatile.
It suggests the degree of change, the amount of fluctuation or shift in their average salary cap percentage over time, was even more pronounced for the middle and bottom groups compared to the top guys. The top tier changed, but maybe more steadily, while the middle and bottom experienced more relative turbulence in their cap share.
Huh, okay. So significant change across the board, maybe even more change happening in the middle and bottom relative to their starting points. But now the big question, the regression results.
Yeah.
Where did the money go?
This is the headline finding from the research, the one the blog post really focuses on. Looking at the whole period, 1984 to 2015, for every additional dollar spent on total league salaries, roughly 72 cents went to players in that top salary tier.
72 cents. Wow. Okay.
About 21 cents went to the middle tier.
21.
And the remaining roughly 7 cents went to the bottom tier.
Okay. Let me just process that. An extra $10 million in league payroll means $7.2 million goes to the top third of players, $2.1 million to the middle third, and only $700,000 to the bottom third.
That's the finding, yeah. It's a pretty dramatic split.
That really drives home the superstar league idea, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The source mentioned the LeBron James effect, how stars drive revenue way beyond just wins and losses. This seems to show that value translating directly into salary distribution when new money comes in.
It certainly suggests that, yeah. Even within a capped system, the economic forces seem to heavily reward that top echelon when the overall pot grows. The rising tide lifts the super yachts way, way higher.
Okay, so that's the picture across the whole modern cap era they studied. But what about the impact of that 1995 CBA? Did things change after the rookie scale and BRI adjustments came in?
Good question. They ran the same regression analysis, but only on the data from the 1995-96 season onwards.
Did the numbers shift?
They did shift, but only slightly. For the post-1995 period, for every additional dollar spent, the top tier got about 70 cents, so down from 72.
Okay, a little less for the top.
The middle tier stayed pretty much the same, still around 21 cents.
Ah, no change there.
And the bottom tier got about 8 cents, so up slightly from 7 cents.
Right, so let me get this straight. After 1995, the top tier share of new money went down by maybe 2 cents, the middle stayed the same, and the bottom went up by 1 cent.
That's what the analysis indicates, yeah.
Okay, now that is really interesting. It's not a huge shift, obviously. 70 cents is still dominating. But the direction of the shift is suggestive, right? The source seems to imply this tiny change might actually be evidence that the union's efforts did matter.
That's exactly the interpretation offered in the source material. It's subtle, but it suggests that those structural changes bargained in 1995 and after, like, the rookie scale, putting a floor ceiling on some contracts, maybe freeing up some money, and the defined BRI split might have slightly counteracted the overwhelming trend towards the top.
Like, it didn't reverse the trend, not even close, but maybe it put the brakes on it just a tiny bit, slowed the rate at which the gap widened.
Perhaps. The source frames it carefully, pointing out the NBA isn't a pure free market. These bargained rules are the main tools the players have to try and influence distribution against what might be the natural tendency for superstars to command ever larger shares. So that small shift could be seen as the impact of those tools.
A small victory, maybe, in trying to make the distribution a little less top-heavy than it otherwise would have been.
Hmm.
Okay, so let's try and wrap our heads around the big takeaways from this deep dive into the research you sent over.
Mm-hmm.
First off, the NBA salary cap era has seen enormous growth in player salaries overall. No surprise there.
Huge growth, yeah.
Second, how that money is distributed has changed significantly over time. It's not static. The relative shares aren't fixed.
Definitely dynamic. The Innova showed that clearly.
Third, the overwhelming winners of that growth, looking at the 1984-2015 period, have been the top-tier players. They capture the vast majority of any new money coming into the league payroll, around 72 cents of every extra dollar.
That's the starkest finding, for sure.
Fourth, however, looking just since the 1995 CBA, there's a hint of small one, but statistically noticeable, that union bargain structures might have slightly altered that distribution, nudging maybe a tiny bit more towards the bottom and slightly less to the very top, compared to the pre-95 trend.
A possible subtle effect of the CBA rules.
And finally, you know, the researchers are clear. It's one study, the data set had some gaps, and the cap era is still unfolding.
Right. It's a complex picture, and this analysis provides a specific economic lens on it for that period. The core conclusion from their work is that despite the cap and union efforts, the structure analyzed still heavily favored the top earners as league revenues climbed.
Which really brings us back to that massive cap spike in 2016 and 2017. The source mentioned was on the horizon when this was written. That wasn't just a small increase, it was a tidal wave of cash.
Unprecedented, yeah.
So the lingering question is, what happened then? Did that huge influx follow the same 70219 pattern seen post-95? Or did the sheer scale of the money, combined with potentially newer CBA wrinkles negotiated since this study, maybe shift the distribution more substantially? Did the middle class finally catch a bit more of the wave, or did the superstars just get even more supersized contracts?
That's the fascinating follow-up, isn't it? What does the most recent data covering that huge spike and the years since actually show? This research gives us a baseline up to 2015, but the story definitely continued.
It absolutely did. Well, this has been a really insightful deep dive. Seriously, thank you for sending the blog post and the research that prompted it. It's exactly the kind of thing we love, taking something familiar like the NBA salary cap and seeing what the data really says underneath.
Glad we could dig into it. It shows how economics plays out even in the world of sports.
Hopefully this gives you a different way to think about player contracts and league economics next time you hear about max deals or the luxury tax. Keep digging into the data on things that make you curious. We'll catch you next time for another deep dive.